Welcome. I'm Jennifer Fraser, and I'm one of the members of the London Critical Pedagogies Group. And we annually hold a Critical Pedagogies Lecture, and this is what we're doing this evening. And so I thought I would tell you very briefly a little bit about what the Critical Pedagogies Group is and why we do this lecture, and a very little bit about Remy, and then I'm going to hand it over to him, because clearly he is the person you've all come to listen to. But the Critical Pedagogies Group began about 8 years ago when a group of us at Birkbeck College had to take a teaching qualification to sort of certify that we were professionally capable of being teachers at universities. And while we were doing that, we decided we really wanted to have more critical conversations about higher education and about our role as teachers and our engagements with students. Learning and teaching more generally. And so out of that came the Critical Pedagogies Group. And we meet about 6 times a year to read over lunch. We have over our lunch and hang about and have a chat over some reading. And this year we've been doing a lot of reading around race and higher education. And so that's one of the reasons that we wanted to ask Remy to come and talk to me. And if you're interested, the group has members from all over the world. We have people who actually Skype in to our meetings, and then people can come physically in. So if you'd like to join us, you're very welcome. There's these sign-up sheets at the back. If you just put your name and your email address on there, we'll get in touch with you. But one of the really interesting things about that group is that it did start with just this tiny number of people who wanted to have these conversations. And then we discovered that there are a lot of people around the place who want to talk about the problems that we face in higher education today. And so it's become this really inter-institutional space. And so about 18 months ago, I moved from Birkbeck to the University of Westminster, which is why we're holding it here tonight. And so I also wanted to say thank you to Roland Denridge, who's at the back, who's our Deputy Vice Chancellor for Student Engagement, who gave us the funding to ensure that our work could continue here. And so a little bit about our annual lectures. We've had about 5 of them in the past. And last year's was by Chanda Prasad-Weinstein, and some of you look familiar, so I think that perhaps you're here. And it was about how to decolonize science. And the other ones have all had those sorts of themes, and Bruce Jones talked to us about intersectional approaches and anti-essentialist pedagogy. And those are the sorts of things that we're really interested in as a group. We will be recording this lecture. We'll also record the question and answer session at the end, but we won't put the question and answer session up online, just the recording. Remy will get the question and answers to help him continue his thinking post-lecture. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about Remy, who's a senior lecturer in the Carnegie School of Education at Leeds Beckett University. His primary research interests are in race and anti-racism. He's a trustee of the Racial Justice Network, and he's a member of the steering group of the Northern Police Monitoring Project. He's also co-editor of the forthcoming collection called The Fire Now, which explores anti-racism in times of explicit racial violence. And I met Remy a few years ago at an event about widening access and participation. And his talk really caught my attention because it moved conversation from access and participation to the structural issues in higher education and the reasons why there are actually issues around access and participation and attainment. And that really struck me as being someone who's making a different conversation happen. And so that's one of the reasons we wanted to invite you tonight. So I'm going to hand it over to him. But just to let you know, if you do need a toilet or anything while you're here, they're all on the ground floor. They're all single stalls, so they're for a variety of genders and needs. And if when you came in, you came through the turnstile, if you had gone right, you would find them just following along. So if you need anything at all, I'll be sitting in the front corner. Just ask questions as we go.
Thanks, Jennifer. Can you hear me in the back with a mic? I never quite know what to do with my face when someone's introducing me. Good evening, everybody. Thank you, Jennifer and the group, for inviting me. Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's great to see that there's obviously an appetite for discussions about these kinds of topics. If the sound isn't okay, someone just shout and let me know, please. So the entry point for my lecture today is that critical pedagogies need to begin with an understanding of the context in which we teach and learn. What I want to explore is the ways in which our universities are underpinned by white supremacy and what this means for the black bodies that pass through them. Just for the sake of clarity, by white supremacy, I'm not referring only to explicitly racist hate groups or Donald Trump, but a structural system of power and domination that privileges white people at the expense of others. I want to think through a particular news story that I'm sure some of you will remember from last year. And I should say that this is just one of many examples that I could have chosen. You can, in fact, there's been a steady stream of similar stories since this time, as well as all those that preceded it. And there are many that are less salient, less obvious, and too often go undiscussed. So as I'm talking, you might want to insert other stories that you're familiar with, or even your own experiences, and situate these alongside the events that I want to recall, and also within the analysis and wider context that I want to offer. I hope that you'll forgive me for reading for most of the lecture, but I want to be precise and make the most of the time. I'll briefly outline what happened in this particular event. I'll touch on some of the theory and the ideas that facilitate the argument that I want to make, and then I'll go into the analysis. So the event I want to talk about took place here, at Oxford University's Harris Manchester College. Looks lovely, doesn't it? On the morning, Friday the 3rd of February 2017, Femi Nylander walked through these grounds. As he did so, he interacted with students and staff that he knew. He even discussed breakfast plans with college staff. The evening before, he'd been to collect a key from his friend's office and been locked in the grounds. Unable to find anyone with a fob to let him out, Femi remained in the grounds working on his forthcoming book until the following morning. The reason I show this, because I want people to keep in mind the kind of space that we're talking about. Femi had graduated from the university less than a year earlier with the university's prestigious Philosophy, Politics and Economics, or PPE, degree. At least for those looking through a post-racial or a colourblind lens then, his being in that space was not unusual. As Femi himself noted, being in someone else's college isn't particularly unusual at Oxford. In Bourgeoisian terms, as he interacted with staff and even engaged in the intellectual endeavour of book writing, Femi appears to possess the habitus to navigate the social field of Oxford. In fact, less than 2 weeks after the incident, an article in The Guardian discussed the cultural, social and symbolic capital that Oxford's PPE degree bestows upon its graduates. And I'll read. More than any other course at any other university, more than any revered or resented private school, and in a manner probably unmatched in any other democracy, Oxford PPE pervades British political life. From the right to the left, from the centre ground to the fringes, from analysts to protagonists, consensus seekers to revolutionary activists, environmentalists to ultra-capitalists, statists to libertarians, elitists to populists, bureaucrats to spin doctors, bullies to charmers, successive networks of PPEists have been at work at all levels of British politics, sometimes more prominently, sometimes more quietly, since the degree was established 97 years ago. And I can see some people are nodding. This is a degree at a particular university that we're familiar with. As the piece made clear, the ability to convert the PPE degree into social mobility, status and influence is near universal. So why was it then that on the morning in question, this CCTV image of Femi was circulated to all staff and students in the college? Why was it deemed necessary, as the circulated email suggested, for staff and students to maintain vigilance? Why is Femi's black body seen to be in direct contrast to the wonderful and safe environment referred to in this email? The post-racial logic of our times, that is, the hegemonic belief that we are now beyond race and racism, we've seen it encapsulated in the royal wedding this weekend, The post-racial logic would suggest that this is absolutely nothing to do with race. It could have happened to anybody, regardless of race. This is an isolated incident that has nothing to do with wider structures. And in fact, by talking about race, is it not the critical race theorist who is the racist? In contrast to these blinkered but popular explanations, I want to argue that Femi's experience is best understood as an example of the predictable ensnaring of black bodies in the web of whiteness that undergirds higher education. My unpacking of this incident, then, is informed by critical race theory, firstly, in its recognition of the ways in which racism is embedded within our societies and institutions, but also, and importantly, in its insistence on the value and legitimacy of the experiential knowledge of people of colour. That is, according to critical race theory, those who are routinely victimised by racism know it best. They are therefore best able to articulate a critique and point out the ways forward. As Solorzano puts it, this knowledge is critical to understanding, analysing and teaching about racial subordination. So with this in mind, that as I explore Femi's experience in more detail, I look to the campaigns of students and staffs of colour as legitimate and valuable sites of critique, and also the foundations from which we can build a counter-narrative that speaks back to the post-racial logic. These campaigns urge us to consider some of the threads that make up and reinforce this web of whiteness. Excavating this wider context is integral to our ability to understand and then challenge the racism that permeate higher education. So now I want to offer theoretical framing that I think helps us to treat these campaigns with the seriousness that they deserve and that enables us to draw upon them in order to situate Femi's experience in its wider context. I want to think about racial microaggressions and bodies out of place. So racial microaggressions, although diverse in their forms, they are everyday racial slights and degradations that racially minoritized people experience. Under post-racial conditions, again the idea that we've overcome racism, under post-racial conditions, microaggressions emerge as the predominant articulation of racism. By that I simply mean we're in a state now where we don't use the N or the P word so much in society, but there are more subtle, often not so subtle, but more deniable forms of racism that take their place. Whilst they can seem innocuous in isolation, it's the accumulation of these experiences of racial microaggressions that threatens to impact upon the well-being, education, and life chances of racially minoritized people. As a number of scholars have shown, racial microaggressions can and do occur, certainly do occur, in the context of higher education. And as Perez, Huber and Solorzano make clear, they are systematically mediated by institutionalized racism and guided by ideologies of white supremacy. And that bit's really important. It's the idea that this everyday manifestation of racism is tied to the institution and the wider structures of our society. It's inextricably tied to those wider structures. In the diagram, you can see, this is from Perez, Huber and Solorzano's article, the microaggression is in the white, the institutional and the macroaggression. They cannot be easily separated. So a task for us then, when understanding incidents like Femi's, and the task I want to take on today is finding those manifestations, those indicators of the institutional and the structural racisms that produce the microaggression. It's the institutional and the macro that make it possible for the microaggression to occur. I realise that some might argue that the event that I'm talking about is not a microaggression, might say that it's too explicit to be seen in this way, and to frame it as a microaggression downplays the seriousness. To be clear, I don't use this conceptualization to downplay the seriousness. I'm mindful that, as Chester Pierce puts it, microaggressions are only micro in name. But I use the concept to capture the deniability of these forms of racism. I would also say that this framing would extend to interpersonal racism more generally. So before I turn to attempt to map out the wider structures, as I said, I will look at bodies out of place. I want to think about what happens when we place work on racial microaggressions in conversation with Nirmal Puwar's work on bodies out of place. For Puwar, while spaces may appear neutral to the uncritical eye, spaces in fact are always racialized and gendered. Whilst formal exclusion from university would stand too starkly in contrast with the post-racial hegemony of our times, informal and subterranean processes can and do continue to mark out the exclusivity of university spaces. These processes have implications for the bodies that occupy those spaces. While some bodies are seen to belong, others become space invaders. The processes by which one is marked as a space invader tell us not only about the experience of the individual, but of the space itself. The space creates the conditions for the routine disruption of invaders. In Femi's case then, the microaggression comes as the consequence of the pre-marking of space. In turn, the microaggression acts to re-signify that space as a space of whiteness and Femi's black body as out of place. Understanding that Femi's experience was not incidental nor accidental, as I attempt to understand the institutional and structural terrain that produced such incidents, it's here that I want to turn to those student and staff campaigns. Attesting to the merit in looking at these campaigns, Puwar suggests that it's only through contestation that the underpinning of spaces become visible. This is because without contestation, these structures are so normal as to be invisible. So I'm going to look at the whiteness of intellect. Why is my curriculum white? Why isn't my professor black? Roads must fall, and I too am. As I do so, I want us to keep Femi's experience in mind, or whichever other experiences you might be familiar with. Any questions? Have I lost anyone so far? No? Shout out if I have. So the whiteness of intellects, this doesn't refer to a particular campaign, but it's a theme that runs through a lot of the campaigns and is at the real heart of a lot of agitation. Dominant histories that position white European bodies as the possessors of intellect and black bodies as inferior and pathological in need of civilization were created to justify enslavement, colonialism and white supremacy. Revered philosophers like Hegel and particularly Immanuel Kant have been more than complicit and explicit in framing blackness in contrast to intellect. In contrast, conversely, through ideas of a white enlightenment and racist science, of which we've seen a resurgence of late, whiteness is seen as synonymous with intellect. As such, we see a process like this. So the university, and particularly Oxford University, is constructed as a place of intellect. Intellect has already been codified as white. As such, the university is not just an intellectual space, but a white space. This is what Puwar's work really encourages us to see. So it's against the ideological backdrop that associates whiteness with intellect that Femi's black body, the presumed antithesis of intellect, is thrown. It's this contrast, a splash of blackness on white canvas, that marks Femi as a body out of place and helps to produce the incident in question. Moving from intellect to the curriculum then, fairly natural progression, the way that intellect is imagined acts to justify and normalise the whiteness of the curriculum. This renders all white male canons the natural, in inverted commas, state of being. Any academic who's attempted to engage in conversations with colleagues who teach canonical theory will know just how natural those canons are thought to be. The reasoning goes that the centrality of those scholars has nothing to do with their whiteness and or maleness, but is merely, and always objectively, because they are the foundational or the best thinkers. Because universities are racial meritocracies, so the reasoning goes, this is merely a case of the cream rising to the top. This is what the Why Is My Curriculum White movement draws our attention to. The emergence of black studies and various movements to decolonize the curriculum similarly make this evident. But it's not only the association between whiteness and intellect that validates the curriculum. In an iterative and mutually reinforcing loop, those very ideas are reaffirmed by the white curriculum. The nature of the loop, the difficulty in tracing which comes first, the association between whiteness and intellect, and the whiteness of the curriculum, this makes it appear as natural and logical. We can no longer trace the starting point. Does that make sense? Yeah. If we return to Perez, Huber and Solizano's assertion that microaggressions are mediated by the institutional and the structural, we can begin to see that Femi's experience is not abstract or isolated, but is inextricably tied to the institutionalized whiteness and structural white supremacy. From this point, Pouard's work shows us how this manifests spatially, as those structures act to codify the university as a white space. Thus, we have a state in which, to borrow from Pouard, white bodies are tacitly designated as being the natural occupants of the university space. Conversely, this renders other bodies, particularly black bodies, out of place. Caught in a web of whiteness, black bodies are subject to risk of being eaten alive by racial microaggressions. So I want to continue in mapping out this web as we draw connections between the whiteness of intellect and the whiteness of the curriculum. We might also turn to the whiteness of the higher education teaching force. Indeed, if we take the voice of staff and students of colour seriously, this is what Why Isn't My Professor Black as a campaign has urged us to do. What we begin to see even more clearly is an interwoven, overlapping, and inter-reinforcing web of whiteness surrounding HE. So in 2013, I'm sure most of you will be familiar with this campaign, Nathan Richards released Absent from the Academy, a documentary film detailing the shocking underrepresentation of black professors. Following that documentary in 2014, a panel discussion at UCL considered that underrepresentation and posed the question, why isn't my professor black? The panel discussed what it meant for higher education that at that time, out of 18,510 professors in the UK, only 85 were black and only 17 were black women. Given the steady increase in the numbers of black students, these figures reflected a considerable disparity between the racial demographic of students and the racial demographic of professors. Attesting to the connectedness of these manifestations of racism, on that panel, Nathaniel Tobias Coleman and William Acker pointed to the association between whiteness and intellect and the overlapping threads that contribute to the whiteness of the professorial body. Perhaps this is what Shirley Ann Tate was pointing to when she suggested that we need to actually reformulate the question in order to think about under what conditions could my professor be black? That is, what would need to change for that to be thinkable and to become a real possibility? Despite the widespread attention both the documentary and the discussions generated, it was perhaps not the catalyst for change that one might have hoped. I can see some of you are not surprised. This is encapsulated by the title of a Times Higher Education article 2 years later, Why Is My Professor Still Not Black? Based upon analysis of the Equalities Challenge Unit's statistical reports on higher education, Robbie Shilliam's work has shown a lack of significant change since 2014 and finds that these disproportionalities are not only manifest in the professorial ranks, but are evident among university lecturers and teaching staff more generally. Should we be at all surprised that black staff, and particularly black women staff, are underrepresented among university lecturers and professors? The ideological coupling of whiteness and intellect, and the subsequent but predictable whiteness of the curriculum, should suggest that an overwhelmingly white body of lecturers is entirely predictable. The underrepresentation of black staff in turn means that those who do occupy white university spaces are, like Femi, positioned as bodies out of place. The mutually reinforcing nature of the web of whiteness begins to reveal itself to us more still here. Black absence from the academy acts to reinforce the notion that intellectualism is a preserve of whiteness, which acts as justification for the whiteness of the curriculum. If we follow this logic to its end, then we might see that these conditions marked Femi's body out of place, a body in contrast to the whiteness of higher education. This isn't the entirety of the picture. Student movements have pained to show us how clearly and how wide-ranging these manifestations are. So the contestation brought forth by the Roads Must Fall campaign shows how architectural structures that may appear neutral are both indicative and constructive of spaces of whiteness. That is, Roads Must Fall shows how architecture is not neutral, but in this case, ideological, racialized, and microaggressive. This is a movement that started in Cape Town in 2015 and quickly spread across South Africa and notably to Oxford in the UK. Those involved in the movement made the case that a statue of an imperialist megalomaniac like Rhodes should have no case on a university campus. Imperialist megalomaniac are the words from their campaigns, but I thought I would use that rather than giving you a background to Rhodes because I think it is reasonably fair. At the University of Cape Town, where students led to the toppling of the campus's statue, those campaigners declared that the fall of Rhodes is symbolic for the inevitable fall of white supremacy and privilege on the campus. Clearly sharing or echoing this sentiment, the Rhodes Must Fall movement at Oxford University stated that the Rhodes statue was a metaphor for the racism that BME individuals continue to experience at Oxford. The university's decision not to take down the statue, they argue, reflects a flagrant disregard for black life. Perhaps a disregard for Femi's black life. Underlying the demonstrators' contestations is a clear sense that manifestations of racism not only interlink, but they support and reinforce each other once again. I realise it might seem that I'm being a bit repetitive with each one, but part of the point I'm trying to make is that students have been telling us these things time and time again. For the protesters, the toppling of the statue is but one symbolic step towards dismantling the white supremacist underpinnings of Oxford University. Interestingly and tellingly, the wider structural focus, the students' call for diversification of the curriculum and the students and staff, but this wider structural focus is always missed from popular representations and particularly the representations or the attacks, critiques in the right-wing media. Metaphorically, we might think of the Rhodes statue as the overseer of the institutionalized whiteness that marked Femi's body out of place. Just as the statue keeps in place those conditions, it's those conditions that keep in place the statue. The architecture, therefore, entangles itself with the curriculum, the white teaching force, and the supposed whiteness of intellect. The entanglement of these multiple threads acts to reinforce and naturalize the university as a white place. Rhodes Must Fall wasn't the only campaign of this kind. It was the most high profile, and the reason I've mentioned it is because it relates to Oxford, where the incident happened, but there were several others, some still ongoing. There's Leopold Must Fall at Queen Mary, which was successful. Galton Must Fall at UCL. Similar campaigns at Princeton, Liverpool, across South Africa, the United States, Ghana. Across the world, people are trying to call for changes in the names of buildings, rethinking about which statues we have on our campuses and which plaques, what we celebrate and what we understand as being our history to be celebrated. The I2M campaign, I'm sure most people will be familiar with because I think it's the most recent, but it came as a homage to Langston Hughes's poem, I2. The I2M photo campaign began at the University of Harvard, and it followed a play that explored the experiences of Harvard's black students. And the release of 33, which was a video produced by students in the School of Law at the University of California, who sought to highlight the woeful underrepresentation of students of color in their school. Students at Harvard held up boards that quoted or described their daily experiences of racial microaggressions. As the campaign's Tumblr page suggests, I2M emerges from a collective sense that black students' voices often go unheard on campus. Their experiences are devalued and their presence is questioned. The campaign then represents a way of speaking back. The Harvard campaign clearly resonated with students at other universities, as similar campaigns quickly followed, and the campaign at Oxford was the most high profile in the UK. And the recurrence of Oxford as a key site of contestation attests to the whiteness that underpins that institution, and again points to the wider context of Femi's experience on that day. The Oxford Tumblr seeks to depict the reality that students in their daily encounters at Oxford are made to feel different and othered from the Oxford community. Through the repetition of racial microaggressions, the whiteness of the university is reinforced. What this produces, according to the I2 I Am Oxford campaigners, is a sense of communal disaffection that students of colour at Oxford have with the university. Therefore, the students point us to the connections between the quotidian experiences of microaggressions and the culpability of Oxford as an institution. Put another way, the students are cognizant of the ways in which institutional whiteness mediates the interpersonal. This is what is at the heart of the students' demands that, and I quote, a discussion on race be taken seriously and that real institutional change occur. The students know that racisms are enmeshed. The students know that the institutional and the structural interventions will need to be brought forth to change their everyday experiences. They know we need to look beyond the surface level manifestation of racism. Although some more explicitly than others, what's displayed on the boards, on the slide, but more so on the Tumblr, nod back to some of the themes that we've discussed. So we see again that students are very, very aware of the wider factors that are causing the microaggressions. We see in the second one in, attention being drawn to the underrepresentation of black staff. The third one, we see the student trying to trouble the association between whiteness and sophistication. Conversely, the disassociation between them and sophistication. And in the last one, we see again this disassociation between intelligence and whiteness. If we look back to the first one, that's the kind of question that emerges as a consequence of these structural factors. What the campaigns really show us is the routine and everydayness of these microaggressions. And this is a point that NUS Black Student President Ilyas Naqdi made just a few months ago when he said, "In my role representing students of colour across the country, I receive daily calls and messages, or I'm alerted to tweets and video reporting incidents of racist abuse on a campus. We have the incidents that are reported publicly and sometimes go viral, the slave auction at Loughborough, the Confederate flag at Manchester, the banana incident at Warwick, and this week the horrific ordeal of Rufaro Chisango at her accommodation at Nottingham Trent. However, the stories that make the headlines every few months are just the tip of the iceberg. Many more never come to light." So we see that Femi's incident is but one of many. It reminds me of my own experience of being asked if I'm supposed to be in here when doing some photocopying in the staff room before teaching. It also reminds me of the stories we're seeing at the moment about black people in Starbucks having the police called on them, that's the space where those bodies are not expected to be. But it's also linked to the much more subtle reminders of our space invading, the jokes, the bad comments, the framing of our work as the consequence of us having a chip on our shoulder. Let us return to Femi. I've long since been the person with the chip on his shoulder. So as Femi's image and the accompanying warning was circulated to staff and students, he's quite literally imagined as a trespasser. He is an intruder or a space invader, and we know, because Pouard tells us, that space invading is not without consequence. His black body threatens to disrupt the whiteness of Oxford, and therefore needs to be regulated, controlled, or removed. Rather than Femi's body disrupting whiteness, it is Femi's body that comes to be disrupted by whiteness. As his criminalised image is circulated, he is reminded of his blackness and his non-belonging in Oxford, and so too are those other black students at Oxford and across the country. Oxford is re-inscribed through this process as a place of whiteness. The unruly black body is re-inscribed as the deviant and criminal black. Thus we see how the web of whiteness extends and entangles itself beyond the realm of higher education and into the criminal justice system. It's worth us thinking too about the role that the prevent agenda plays in maintaining these links. This is another lesson that we might take from student campaigns. The pressure for universities and university staff to monitor and place under surveillance their students, student campaigns have shown us that that is disproportionately applied to black and brown students. I touched earlier upon the association between intellect and whiteness, and here we see the association between blackness and criminality. Femi as criminal fits much more readily into his interlocutor's racist schema than does Femi as intellectual. Like intellect and whiteness, blackness and criminality is a powerful association with deep roots. As Doner and Brown observe, being black and male, irrespective of societal position, recapitulates the historically and ideologically informed racial imaginary of black male deviance and criminality. Keeping in mind the discussion of Oxford's PPE degree, this point is particularly apparent in Femi's case. Despite his graduating with that degree, the most revered degree in the country, and the societal position that it supposedly imbues, and in contrast to popular post-racial logic, Femi's presence in the university space is governed by a racist imaginary that reduces him to the proverbial black monster. Governed by a racist episteme of certitude, the white gaze does not see a student, but instead a body out of place. As I've argued, microaggressions are the surface level, everyday, interpersonal manifestations of institutional whiteness and structural white supremacy. It's the structural and institutional that create the fertile conditions for microaggressions, and in turn, those microaggressions keep in place those structures. We might see microaggressions, therefore, as creating and maintaining white space, creating and maintaining Oxford as a white space. In those moments when Femi was identified as a criminal and a trespasser, the historical weight of white supremacy and the ideological and historical weight of Oxford bore down on him. This was not an individual aberration, but a reminder of those structures, a reminder of the ways in which space is racially codified, and a reminder that while some bodies are imagined as belonging, others are always susceptible to being marked as out of place. What happened cannot be seen in abstraction from the teaching force, the curriculum, the architecture, and the university policies that maintain white supremacy. If we see microaggressions as only isolated incidents, we are ill-prepared to do the work that needs to be done. If we tackle only one thread, and particularly if we only confront the most visible, our efforts are destined to be futile. By identifying and tackling multiple threads, including the institutional and structural, we stand a greater chance of disrupting racism. By taking the counter-narratives of racially minoritized students seriously and utilizing racial microaggressions as a theoretical conduit, and appreciating the ways in which spaces are racialized, we are better able to move more forcefully towards disrupting the whiteness of higher education. By disrupting the whiteness of higher education, we are able to create spaces in which black bodies can belong. Thank you.